Good morning and welcome on RN. This is Books and Arts and I'm Michael Cathcart. And it's all about writers this morning. Brisbane author Chrissy Neen, her new novel is called Steeplechase.
This is a book about two sisters who were brought up very, very close together, basically not really allowed to socialise with their community in a small country town. The mother has lost her mind and the older sister seems to be going the way of her mother and developing a kind of an imaginary life that becomes more and more real, and the younger sister feels like she's being left behind from this imaginary world.
And talking of imaginary worlds, Barbados-born writer Karen Lord takes us into her world of speculative fiction. But first, a book about remembering the past and trying to live in the present. The Memory Trap is a new novel from Andrea Goldsmith. It's the story of two brothers and two sisters who grew up next door to each other in suburban Melbourne. Now they're adults and they're getting on with their bruised and muddled lives. And one factor which has shaped their destinies is that one of those brothers, Ramsey, is a freakishly gifted pianist with an international recording career. But his miraculous playing comes at a considerable cost for, well, for most of the people in the book, actually. This is Andrea Goldsmith's seventh novel, and it pursues her familiar themes of love and relationships, ambition, art and music. And it's got a good deal to say, too, about monuments and memorials, which is a good theme to be discussing on the day before Anzac Day. Lots to talk about. Andrea, welcome.
Hi, Michael. Good to be here.
So nice to have you here. Now, let's set the tone for this book with some music. I'm going to play a little bit. Oh, I'm not going to play it. We'll play a recording of a little bit of Beethoven's Cello Sonata No. 4 in C major. Just set this up for us. What's the significance of this piece?
This is, it's a deceptively simple sonata, cello and piano. And it's the first piece that Ramsey, our very gifted pianist, who's a half-baked human being in every other respect, plays with one of the sisters from next door, and they're both around the age of 14 or 15. And it's the first piece that they study together and they perform together. And it sets the stage for at least Zoe, the sister's lifelong passion for Ramsey. And various times over the years, they actually touch base with this piece and thereby touch place with a connection between them.
Well, we'll just hear a little bit of the opening. So imagine that the brother is playing, Ramsey's playing the piano and Zoe's playing the cello, and just listen to the way in which essentially they're talking to each other. Seems such a shame to talk, doesn't it? This is such beautiful music. I just want to go on listening. That's the Beethoven Cello Sonata No. 4, Amir Farid on the piano and Zoe Knighton on the cello. In fact, the recording that you particularly love, which is not that one, is quite poignant, isn't it?
Yeah, the recording I have is the Baron Boehm de Pré recording. And, you know, I feel the connection between the players. And it's
so Daniel Barenboim playing the piano and Jacqueline Dupre playing the cello.
And, of course, they were married. They were. And there was the tragic end to Jacqueline Dupre with MS. Just listening to that music then, it's, to me, the cello is leading. And in the story, Zoe, the only time she ever actually leads Ramsey is in that piece. The rest of the time she's absolutely in thrall, I was about to say to him, but it's actually to her imagined him.
So Zoe is in love with this boy next door, Ramsey.
Obsessed
him. Obsessed. Mm. obsessively in love. Mm. And he seems not to understand this. And that's the case from when they're teenagers right through into adulthood.
Mm. Yeah, it's Nina, the other sister. She's an interesting character. She is an international consultant on memorial projects. Her subject is memory. She helps groups devise and bring to fruition memorials. Solid memory is what she works in. And at one point in the book, she makes the observation that genius seems to stunt everything except its own specialty. And I think this is what's happened with Ramsey. And it's sort of not surprising. He's been playing the piano for most of his waking hours since the age of two.
It's as if all of his humanity is being poured into the music and he's got none left for anything else.
And the interesting thing is, though, that he does seem to become a complete person when he's playing.
Yeah.
It's as if the music finds deep inside him things, aspects of him that the rest of the life they're just not apparent.
You know, Andrea, as I was reading the book, I so believed that Ramsey was a great pianist with a great recording career. It was all I could do to stop myself going onto YouTube to see if I could, you know, see him there. Because actually, you say he's got videos on YouTube. I thought, I'll go and listen to those. Oh, no, I can't. He doesn't exist. Andrea made it up.
That's wonderful.
So the one person who is in step with him, ironically, is his stepfather, George. So George marries into the family, marries Ramsey's mum, and really takes on the boy as a project.
He does, and we never find out why, what his motivation is. George is a shadow through a part of the book, and it's really up to us to work out what he's getting out of Ramsey. But the fact is, he too becomes fixated on Ramsey to the exclusion of the other children, who by now are sort of late teenagers, and the atmosphere is so toxic and so exclusive that Sean, the brother that was once so close to Ramsey, he leaves home as early as possible, and so does Nina.
All right, so let's just explain that. So Ramsey has this brother, Sean, who is another shadowy figure in a way. So Sean is a great mate of Ramsey's, in fact, turns the pages for him. That's what he loves doing, sitting beside him when he's playing the piano and turning the pages, as great pianists often require you to do. And then one day he's no longer required. George says, "We don't need you, Sean. Go away." Ramsey knows this music off by heart. And Sean has lost his place in the family. That's how totally this brother's talent defines the dynamics of the household.
It's exactly right. And Sean, we actually meet all of these characters in their 40s. And Sean, by this stage, he has a career as a travel writer. He eats too much. He drinks too much. He's constantly on the move, despite having a long-suffering partner, Tom, who lives in Melbourne. And what has driven Sean is this rupture with his brother that happened, you know, when they were teenagers. It's not something that he has wanted to face. It's not something he's wanted to deal with. But through the course of this novel, there are certain events and happenings that occur that actually force him to take stock of his life.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and I'm talking to Andrea Goldsmith about her new novel, which is called The Memory Trap. Andrea, let's try and focus now, as we discuss the book, just on Ramsey, the pianist, and those two sisters and how he affects their lives. So there's Zoe, the girl who's obsessed with him, and her sister, who is, what's her name?
Nina.
That's right. So Zoe is obsessed with the boy next door, but the terrible thing is that she goes off and gets married to someone else. She marries an American called Elliot, who, when we first meet him, we think, "You utter bastard.
Yep.
You brute. You, oh, I know men like you. You are an utter cad." And then, well, this is what's so good about this book. You manage the flow of information so beautifully. So you take us all on a holiday down on the Great Ocean Road, which is on the coast of Victoria, windswept, wild place to be. And we see why it is that Elliot is such a pain.
Yes. You know, when you start writing books, you have perhaps a firmer idea of the characters you have at the beginning than you do at the end, I have to say. And initially, Elliot, who's married to Zoe, he was the baddie. But I should say something else about Elliot. Elliot is an alcoholic, but he gave up booze years ago. But from his point of view, his wife is still addicted to the pianist Ramsey. Elliot loves his wife. He is living with somebody whose emotional and passionate life is directed elsewhere. And while it doesn't excuse his, he can be quite brutal to Zoe, it doesn't excuse his behaviour, but it certainly helps explain it. And we understand what's happening to him at the same time as Nina, Zoe's sister, understands.
Yeah. So they go on this holiday. Mm. He thinks he's going on a holiday with his wife, a lovely holiday away down at the beach, and she does, I mean, something unforgivable, actually, really. She asks this boy, who is not a boy anymore, this man, Ramsey, to come. And that's when we know for sure that she's in love with him. She's in love with him in her adulthood, and that Elliot is closed out. And we feel his rage.
And feel his immense sadness. And we get it via, actually, Nina's observations, because Nina has never felt particularly fondly towards her brother-in-law either, but she sees what's happened. Her sister Zoe is so wrapped up in this passion for Ramsey that she has lost all perspective. She's got two teenage, well, actually teenage children. One's 20, the other's 16, and she loses perspective on them as well.
She stops caring for them.
She stops seeing them.
Stop noticing
them.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Yes.
And now, the interesting thing to me about Elliot, I mean, there's lots that's interesting about him, but one thing that particularly tickle my fancy is that he's written a biography of Elizabeth Hardwick. And this is just to do with the way in which this radio program, Books and Arts, is an absolute funfair of coincidences, because only last week we were talking to Robert Silver, who founded the New York Review of Books with Elizabeth R. Hardwick.
That's
50
right.
years ago. So I interview him, I come home and read your book, and there's a man writing a biography of Elizabeth Hardwick. Why is Elliot so drawn to her?
Well, Elliot might have actually borrowed this from the author. I found that whole partisan review, New York Review group of people that got together, intellectuals that got together in the 40s and 50s and just continued on. I've always found them fascinating and their work fascinating. And Elizabeth Hardwick died not so long ago. And as Elliot is a biographer, he writes biographies of big women. He is also American. Elizabeth Hardwick was a perfect choice for him. And it would keep me, the author, interested.
Well, there was a resonance for me, and that is that she was married to Robert Lowell, who was, in his way, an impossible genius. Mm. So I thought there was a little resonance there.
And there absolutely was, because he's another artist, though I actually think that Robert Lowell was known to be quite mad, but as Elizabeth Hardwick always said, he was a genius always, genius even in his madness.
Now, Andrea Goldsmith, this novel of yours, The Memory Trap, is full of music, lots of classical music and lots of popular music from the 60s and 70s, lots of rhythm and blues. What's the place of music in your own life?
It's big. I played the piano when I was young. I play appallingly badly now, and only me and my dog actually listen. But music can speak to you when nothing else can. And in this particular novel, this is a novel also about loss and about absence, the loss of ambitions, the loss of love, the loss of hopes. And it seems to me that sometimes language lets us down in a way that music never does. In fact, George Steiner said, when it came to music, language was lame. And I'd turn it around that when it comes to emotions, often music can inform us what they're all about and indeed placate them in a way that language can't. This is how I use it in my life.
Mm. Well, let's hear some more music. So this is a piece that Ramsey, this gifted pianist, plays. It's by Messiaen, Olivier Messiaen. And it's from a piece called 20 Contemplations of the Child Jesus. This is contemplation number 10. What do you want to say about this?
This is this whole piece of music, the Vingt Regards, the 20 Contemplations, is the most extraordinary piece of music. Messiaen was a deeply religious man. And, of course, having Ramsey play this piece, who doesn't have religious bone in his body, was done very deliberately. This is number 10. Mm-hmm.
immensely exciting, isn't it?
It takes breath away.
It does.
It's fabulous.
That's the Norwegian pianist Håkon Austbø having a go at that. So there are, how many are there? 20. There are 20 like that. Yeah. I'll tell you something. I got to know this piece on YouTube. I hadn't heard it before. And so when it came up in the book, I watched it on YouTube. Have you discovered those YouTube videos where you can follow the sheet music as the person's playing?
No.
It's really extraordinary. So the one I was watching is playing this piece by Messiaen. They're all there. And the four bars that you're hearing are up on the screen. And it's a little bit alarming because, of course, you sort of anticipate when you're reading music before the music's played. So it's almost coming too late. But you do get to watch the music whizzing by as it's played. It's quite an exciting experience.
This is fantastic because it's interesting when Ramsey's playing this piece, Sean, who hasn't seen his brother for 15 years, walks in, he hears this marvellous piece, comes into the music room and... Of their childhood house, where he's not been for God knows how long. And actually, Ramsey stops, he hands him the score and Sean follows. Mm. And I think that that's kind of an interesting role for the brother of the once loved genius, but also for anybody following music, you follow on the music.
I took that as a gesture of reconciliation, though.
Yes, I think it is.
That was, you know, 20 years overdue, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, let's talk about the other sister. So we've been talking about Zoe, who's the sister who's hopelessly in love with this amazing pianist who doesn't love her back. Her other sister is Nina Jamison, and her marriage has fallen apart. She's in New York, or is she in London?
No, she's in London.
She's in London, that's right. She's in London, but she's a bit of a jet setter, so we pick her up in London and in New York. And she's a consultant on memorials. So if you're planning to set up a memorial to people who've been killed in a disaster or to a citizen who you admire or to celebrate world peace, you ring up Nina Jamison, get her on the phone, and she will put the deal together for you, tee you up with the people who make monuments, design this, but also workshop with you what you want.
Yes.
And in the book, you show her actually working with a client and persuading them that actually they don't want a water feature to try to create world peace, because a water feature is not the way to world peace. It isn't going to work and everyone's going to be disappointed. She's part of this great, in some ways this is a book about homecomings really, but she's an expert on memorials and they are this other theme in the book. You've obviously thought a lot about memorials.
I have. The Memory Trap is really about memory at personal level, in personal relations, personal lives, and also memory at a national level, and this is where the monuments come in. And of course, whilst there are differences, there are also similarities. Memory, whether at the national level or the personal level, is always in service to the present. So, for example, during the Stalin years, his statue was all over the Soviet Union. By the mid-50s, most of them had come tumbling down. And, of course, we remember the statues of Saddam Hussein coming tumbling down. Similarly, at a personal level, memories are in service to the present. I mean, we ransack certain aspects of memory over and over again, and my characters do that too. But Nina's work shows how nations actually do it. And yes, I'm fascinated by memorials, that idea of making solid something that is essentially abstract.
Do you have a favourite in all the world? Is there a memorial you think is, or a commemorative sculpture that you think, that's a corker?
I couldn't say. It's a bit like asking, do I have a favourite piece of music? And I can't say.
Well,
I
is do. There a memorial to a piece of music that particularly strikes
that's
you, or to a composer?
I do like the Sibelius one, but...
That's the Sibelius Monument in Helsinki,
right.
Which are these like great organ pipes.
And that's why there's something that's wonderfully organic as well as musical about it, but I think that there are different memorials for different moods. I like memorials that have lots of reflective space for you, the visitor. So, for example, I actually do like the Princess Diana Memorial Fountain in Hyde Park.
So this is a great circular fountain.
Yes.
It's actually not really a fountain. It's a kind of water race.
It's a water reel, and it's a ring of water that is on a slope. And goodness knows what the physicists or engineers did, the way this water moves. But When I've been there, I haven't given really any thought whatsoever to Princess Diana, but it's actually started me thinking of other things. There's a lot of reflective space. So,
and the water moves over different surfaces, yes, and so the noise of it changes as you walk
that's
around
right.
the ring.
Mm,
yeah, mm, the book itself is full of monuments, isn't it? I mean, one evening, Elliot, this is this American who's discovered he's married to the sister who doesn't love him because she's in love with the pianist. One evening, Elliot, who's retreated to a van, he's living basically in some bushland in inner Melbourne, he goes home to dinner with an Aboriginal woman who turns out to be a Christian pastor. And it's a very strange encounter and a very actually companionable and healing encounter. And her house is full of pictures of herself and her dead husband, the house is a kind of memorial to their marriage.
I think we make monuments in our lives. In Beth's case, the character's name's Beth, there are groups of little stone animals and goddesses, and there's photos. And on her husband's side of the bed, he died about 3 months before we meet her. There's a short pile of books, there's his watch, there's a folded man's hanky, and it is a memorial to her husband. And I think that we make these memorials, all of us, in our everyday lives. Another type of memorialising is, you know, the drooped bunch of flowers that's taped to an electricity pole on,
yes,
on a highway. Something very moving about these sorts of private memorials.
Now, time is almost over. We've only got a minute left, but I do want to draw attention to the astonishingly complex structure that you've managed in this book. So we actually open with Nina, the memorial expert in London. She returns to Melbourne, and then we get basically the backstory. We get the intervening years. And so you bring in, it's as though you've created a great big story that you've made out of bigger paving stones. And one by one, the paving stones from different time periods float into view and then settle. And we gradually understand how the full picture is. I mean, you created an extraordinarily complex task for yourself. Did you always intend to manage time in this very
No.
fluid way?
I always wanted to, but I'm really happy to go along with what you say, Michael, that it all just seems to fit together, and that's what you want in the end. A novel that seems to have just fallen into place. And that's what I would always be after.
Well, it certainly falls into place. That's what I actually had a sense of all the way through, that this is a story in which memories and experiences and making sense of things falls into place. Andrea Goldsmith, thank you for being my guest this morning. It's been lovely talking to you.
Thanks, Michael.
Andrea Goldsmith, her book is called The Memory Trap. It's published by Fourth Estate. And here's just a taste of my own favourite piece of piano music, the Goldberg Venerations. They're variations. They're played by the legendary Glenn Gould. This is the 1981 recording of Variation number 1.